Morning. In 2022, the IFOA published a series of articles under the Inclusion Insurance series that included the impact of poverty premium. Poverty premium refers to the extra costs incurred by low-income households when purchasing same or similar essential goods and services as households on compared to households on higher incomes. The ASSA Poverty Premium Working Group was established in 2022 following the publication of papers and a call from ASSA for volunteers. A lot of meetings and discussions have taken place to date. And to share our poverty premium journey and discussion, the working group published an article in the South African Actuary in the April 2024 publication. And secondly, we thought that the LACS seminar would also be a great platform to reflect on our journey. Rather than presenting our article, we thought it best to have a panel discussion with some of the individuals, great individuals, that we engage with. So I'll introduce the panel, and when I introduce them, could they please come up and sit from, I'll be sitting here from the second seat. Our first panelist is Professor Alex van der Heever. He has an MA Economics from the University of Cape Town. He holds a chair of the Social Security Administration and Management Studies at the Wits School of Governments. He has worked in the areas of health economics, public finance, governance, and social security since 1989. His work largely focuses on strategic policy research for social security and health systems. Professionally, he has worked for the Department of Finance, which is now National Treasury, the Industrial Development Corporation, the Center for Health Policy at Wits, the Gauteng Department of Health, Deloitte and Touche, and the Council of Medical Schemes. He has also formed part of various inquiries into the field of health and social security, including the Malamath Commission on Medical Schemes, the Taylor Committee of Inquiry into Comprehensive Social Security, the Ministerial Task Team on Social Health Security. He has also chaired two expert panel investigations into a basic income support grant for South Africa, supported by the International Labour Office. He's also served on various official bodies, including the Council of Medical Schemes and the Medicine Pricing Committee. Next, I'd like to introduce Megan Coswell. Megan Coswell is an actuary and adjudicate professor at the University of Wits. She has corporate experience in both group life assurance and pensions and has published and presented on the South African social security system locally and abroad. She's an active member of the ASSA Social Security and Retirement Reform Working Group and was involved in the development of the ASSA Subject F108 Health, Social, and Employee Benefits Fellowship Principles. Next, I will introduce Lusani. Lusani is a healthcare actuary, independent non-executive director, and lecturer. He's a trained design thinking practitioner and is passionate about innovation. He has worked as a CEO of a health administrator and managed care organization, worked as a healthcare actuary of a large healthcare administration and managed care organization, and as an actuarial consultant for a large insurance company in South Africa. He is an independent non-executive director for a couple of private insurance companies and does public interest work for ASSA. In 2020, he joined the University of Cape Town as a lecturer. In addition to his professional work, Lusani is involved in leadership structures of several community development organizations. He's a president of ASSA from 2020 to 2021. The next speaker is François Meret. François Meret is a retired actuary with extensive experience in the insurance industry. He qualified as an actuary as a fellow of the Institute of Actuaries in 1980, when ASSA had less than 300 fellow members and about 10 new qualified actuaries was a good year. Most of his career was at Sanlam, initially in employee benefits, but later moved to individual product development. He retired in 2007 at the ripe age of 55. During his career, he served on the boards of ASSA, UWC, the LOA, BestMed Medical Aid, and various retirement funds. After retirement, he obtained a master's degree in business ethics, cum laude at Stellenbosch, with a thesis on ethical justification of discrimination in risk underwriting in the life insurance industry. And our last speaker who's online is Richard Montgomery. Richard started work in the direct life insurance space before working in reinsurance. In 2001, he went on his own doing consulting and contracting work. Recent work is mostly related to life protection products, but he has worked in other wider fields, from training to policy remediation. For the past 12 years, he has been based in the UK, but retains links to the South African profession through work on various committees. This includes the TCF committee, the market committee that replaced it, and of course the poverty premium working group. So let's start from the beginning. Richard, could you please give us a quick reflection on the UK perspective? Thank you.
Okay, thanks, thanks, Sandy. Greetings, everyone, from the UK, where it's a lovely spring morning. We do sometimes have such things. I suppose the first question was, why something from the UK? Well, it is where the original poverty premium paper was written, under the banner of the Institute and Faculty of Actuaries and the Fair by Design Fund. I would also suggest that there are many similarities between South Africa and the UK, and a few differences that could provide some interesting contrast. A quick take on the current position. The UK economy, I would say, is in a bit of strife. The old welfare safety nets are under strain. Higher levels of poverty are evident. We have a deep class system and divides are keenly felt. Ironically, half the population spends their time trying to claim their working class roots, and the other half go around pretending to be posh, and both are lying. But overall, we have a compliant, aging population with a well-established surf mentality. If you look at the prevalent TV ads today, they cover things like equity release, pensions consolidation, funeral or cremation plans, incontinence pads, and over 50s life cover. The life cover ads emphasize things like we pay every claim and no pesky and invasive medicals. And the rate per mille is, of course, sky high. So the poverty premium becomes evident in the UK in many ways where poorer people pay more for their cover. This happens naturally through rating factors and higher expense ratios, but it's also coming through product fragmentation, postcode differences, absence of advice, poorer people not getting access to decent advice. And there's a lot of marketing into less price sensitive channels, e.g. TV ads using celebrity people to push overpriced products. Now, I would suggest that all of those will be found in the South African market as well, along with some unique features. And it's those unique features that I think Alex will be picking up on. So I think this is a good time to hand over to him.
Thanks, Richard. While the poverty premium is a concern in the UK, we do know that the impact is more pronounced here in South Africa with such a large inequality gap. And so, Professor van der Heever, please do share some insights into the drivers of poverty in South Africa and why it's such a uniquely complex South African problem.
Well, I think South Africa presents a range of problems that are very difficult to solve. And when you talk about sort of commercial insurance environment and their role in trying to solve certain of their problems, there are extreme limits. And I'm going to sort of run into explain some of those. I mean, as everybody knows, dealing with risks and contingencies involves pooling arrangements. And in the case of, and there are two basic forms of pooling that are important in social security and in broad systems generally. One's called a vertical pooling and the other is horizontal pooling. And the vertical pooling, just very simply, is transfers from higher income people to lower income people. And that's a very difficult thing for commercial markets to solve because it focuses largely on the other aspect of pooling, which is horizontal pooling, from people who don't have experienced the relevant contingency today to those that do. So it's a transfer from it's a risk transfer to the few people who have to claim benefits at any point in time. Vertical transfers typically involve taxation, some form of taxation of people, which is very difficult for a commercial market to deal with. So the question is, which contingencies fall into that range? And when we look at the problems we have in South Africa, they run very deep, and they're exacerbated by factors such as poor economic growth and high levels of unemployment that are quite unique to the South African context. And even the Southern African region, a lot of countries in the Southern African region reflect the same patterns. So our unemployment rates tie into our inequality levels and into our high levels of poverty. So that problem can't entirely be solved, even with government transfers. It has to be solved by getting economic growth back in. But you also have to deal with dealing with the contingencies that come with people living in dire poverty. So the problem is really how to solve multiple problems. And poverty is a complex problem. Income poverty is an easier problem to solve than multifaceted poverty. And the problem is that many people get segmented into difficult circumstances because they're facing multifaceted levels of poverty. They're living in communities that hold them down to a large extent, can't be easily supported, can't support them with jobs, education, come from communities which can have a negative effect on people's ability to transition out of that environment. So it is immensely complex, and it depends very much on government getting its act together. So the question is, what does the commercial insurance environment have to offer? It's sometimes very difficult because the problem with people at the lower income spectrum is that they're not part of group schemes, they can't join through companies, and so the transaction costs, the costs of actually selling products into that environment is too high for many people, and the anti-selection risks are too high for people to charge lower premiums. So in fact, it can be very difficult to sell certain kinds of products into that environment. The other problem is that there are certain contingencies that the market just can't cover. Unemployment can't be covered easily. Death and disability can't be covered very easily, other than through some kind of low savings product. And those don't really help low-income communities very much because they don't provide cover for very long. So this is the problem that we face in South Africa, is how to design a system that can cross the spectrum while we're also sitting in a country where, unfortunately, government has been responsible for undermining economic growth for quite a while. Government has to get growth going. So we have to look at this full range, but the question, and I won't conclude on this, is really that the industry still has a role to play on understanding the problem and looking at where it can make a difference that's positive and not negative. And sometimes the way products are sold into the low-income markets can be essentially predatory and can have very concerning impacts on low-income communities. So, for instance, in the case of funeral products and things like that, can be sold into the environment where people have difficulty even claiming the benefit because they stop paying premiums when they get ill and disabled prior to death, and they can't even claim the benefit at the end of the day after having contributed. So that kind of risk can occur and is problematic. So one wants to counter that kind of thing in the design of products, but there are limits to what the commercial markets can solve. I'll leave it there.
No, thank you. After a conversation that we had with you and Vivek, we were quite overwhelmed, talking about the multifaceted poverty. We're also quite excited, lots of emotions, as this problem is indeed complex. We went back to our working group to give them feedback. What we realized is that indeed there's so many stakeholders and parties that we need to engage and to partner with, but we also needed to broaden our understanding, including one of those was actually speaking to the public interest actuary. So Lusani, how does poverty premium integrate to the wider ESSA public interest platform?
I think just the very fact that we are having this conversation is helpful for the actuarial society. And I think it is a sign of maturity in the profession that these type of public interest matters take center stage. As a leader or an organization that has an ambition to be a leader in context-based solutions, which means to be relevant and to deal with relevant issues. And this is an issue that our current president, Costa, has been championing, that we remain relevant. So although we may have different views or different ways in which some of these problems need to be highlighted, Alex has highlighted several aspects around governance, which maybe we cannot do much about, but we need to challenge ourselves around what contribution can we make on the governance side or on the capacity of the state. I'll say a little bit more about that. But then also there's a more immediate challenge around what we're doing in our roles, in our companies, etc. I think the whole issue of profit margins and how we look at products is maybe something quite interesting. I was doing a presentation recently, and I was looking at profit margins during COVID in different industries in the US, and you get some interesting aspects there in terms of values and what people treasure and so on. And if you were to investigate in the world what are some of the most profitable activities to get involved in, you find that some of the activities are not the most legitimate activities to get involved in. But the question that we need to ask ourselves, he spoke about predatory practices and so on. I think that is where it starts with us in industry, just to look at in terms of how we sell products and the kind of products we sell and the kind of underwriting mechanisms we have in place, the underwriting controls at claim stage, how predatory are those, and how much do we favor our profit margins at the expense of the most vulnerable in society. So those are the questions that are closer to home. But I think what is more difficult, though, is the approach of saying, how do we actually extend benefits more widely to society? And how do we deal with the issues of governance or government or policy that are a problem? So many of us, we may limit our horizons in terms of that because we've only ever been trained in a free market system, free market solutions, and working for proprietary insurance companies. I think some would be lucky, like Francois, you worked for a mutual company, and there's still quite a few maybe that work for one or two mutual companies that are still there. So therefore, the perspective that we may have or we may share here may be very different to what is required in order to solve the problems that Alex is talking about here. So it's good that we have someone like him coming to challenge us here. But I think that this discussion that you've highlighted, it may possibly help us. And I think what will be required, this is an opportunity for us to just unshackle ourselves from any of the other things that we are used to, and just really grab the opportunity to be innovative and think of what are the hidden costs of being poor and what can we do to address them. So this is something that for the Actuarial Society is important. And the research work that may culminate from this work that has been happening in the discussion, it may lead to some policy papers or policy briefs, which we have some experience in doing, and that may ultimately affect our regulations and even public policy. So that is what we hope for ultimately. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks, Lusani. I'm Francha. So underwriting and life insurance. You did a thesis on ethical justification on discrimination and risk underwriting in the life insurance industry. Could you touch on some key aspects of the paper and how it talks to poverty premium?
thank you. I must say I was very flattered when the working group quoted my old convention paper from about 6 years ago. For those of you who have written it, on the front page of the article, I must say when I did the paper, the concept of poverty premium was not even part of my vocabulary. So things do progress. The purpose of my thesis was to consider the ethical justification of the discrimination in risk underwriting that we all do. In other words, I tried to see whether I could ethically justify what I've been doing for many years in Sanlam, in product development. And referring to this quote, It's true what it says, that the rich, young, non-smoking women gets 50% more, 50 times more life cover than the poor old male smoker for the same premium. But this is, that's an extreme example, and I think we must just drill down into it a bit to see what part of that is really the poverty premium. The four main discrimination criteria in life underwriting, as like you all should know, age, sex, smoking habit, and socioeconomic class or socioeconomic status. Of these four, age is by far the most significant, with a 20-year-old getting about 6 times more cover for the same premium than a 60-year-old. And that was, for many decades, that was the only discrimination practice. When I was born in the 1950s, that was still the only rating discrimination in life insurance. And then over time, things started to get more sophisticated. Gender discrimination was introduced in the 1960s, when I was in primary school. And it's the most modest discrimination factor. Females, initially it was a 3-year discount on age for females, which is about a 15% discount. And now females get about 1.5 times more cover for the same premium than our male counterparts. Smoking is treated as a much more serious problem than sex. Non-smokers get 2 times the cover on average that smokers get. And that's across the board. It's not even at the ages where you die of smoking-related lung cancer. It's even if you're 20. If you're smoking, you're a bad risk. But the discrimination, based on the fourth factor, the socioeconomic class, what we're talking about today, is much more significant than any of the others, except for age. And it's rather unique to South Africa. It's also much more complex. It's not a binary distinction between male, female, or smoking, non-smoking. Typically goes from the lowest class, let's say the class 1, to a top class 4, so 4 different classes. And it's defined in terms of a combination of income and education level. And obviously there's a big correlation between income and education as well. So the rich top class 4 gets about 4 times the cover that the poor bottom class 1, other things being equal, get for the same premium. And that is where you can really see the poverty premium quantify in underwritten life insurance. And to put this in a bit more specific perspective, socioeconomic class 1 has got no income requirement. You can be as poor as you want. While class 2 requires, well, when I wrote this five years ago, it was 16,000 per month income, probably be 20,000. Let's make it 20,000 per month income now. If you earn less than 20,000, for the same amount of insurance, you pay double the premium than your brother that earns just more than 20,000 earns. And it's really at the edges of the classes that the discrimination seems most unfair. Because if you earn, if 20,000 is the cutoff point, if you earn 19,000 and your friend earns 21,000, you still pay double the premium he pays for the same cover. And that is hard to justify. So in my paper, I argued that the discrimination on the criteria of age and gender and smoking status can be justified in ethical terms as fair for actuarial equity, that is our principle of fairness. They meet the three criteria required to be considered as fair, which I think is they're based on strong, reliable statistical evidence. They have a reasonable causal explanation as well. I mean, always remember that correlation does not prove cause, which you probably teach all the, you know, if there's a strong correlation between going to bed with your shoes on and having a headache in the morning, doesn't prove that the shoes actually causes the headache. It just proved that you were drunk when you went to bed. There must be a strong causal explanation. And then the last one is there must be unambiguous allocation of each individual risk to a risk group, which is clearly easy to determine as far as age and gender and smoking habit is concerned. But the discrimination on the socioeconomic status only meets the first two requirements. Strong, very strong statistical evidence. And there is a strong causal explanation. But it does not allow for unambiguous allocation to risk groups. Like I've already just demonstrated, at the edges of the classes, it gets more clear that this is a difficult qualification. And the problem is that all insurers have different combinations of education and income levels, and there's no clear, uniformly accepted definition of socioeconomic status. So the statistics is also a bit blurry around the edges and who classifies what is where in your statistical analysis. And the definition is not stable because if there's an income element, it has to be adjusted for inflation all the time. So that allocation of an individual to a risk group is not unambiguous. And so my conclusion after all of that was that the industry would really find it hard to justify our discrimination in terms of socioeconomic status if we were ever to be challenged on this in court under the, can't get the long name right, but the Prohibition and Prevention of Unfair Discrimination. And we must always remember we're talking about unfair discrimination. Discrimination is a good thing if it's not unfair. I mean, if you're not discriminate, you're indiscriminate, which is not good. But the problem is unfair discrimination, and I think the industry will not be able to justify our classification into socioeconomic if we're ever challenged, but we have never been challenged, so it's probably will carry on like that. But then the point that I want to make also is that this is the discrimination in terms the poverty premium in terms of fully underwritten insurance, which is, as far as the bottom class, class one, the poorest class, is really even not relevant because they don't buy fully written right life insurance. So, I mean, you can quantify it as such, but that doesn't really affect them. That part of the population buys funeral insurance. And there, it's a totally different ballgame, and I think we must just get back to that one later.
Thanks, Rantra. Megan, from your experience, how do the social security themes integrate into poverty premium?
As an actuary, I always find it quite humbling to remember that the insurance industry and the employee benefits industry actually form such a very small part of social security as a whole, because social security as a whole also includes social assistance, what we call grants in this country, as well as social insurance, things like the unemployment insurance fund and the compensation fund. And these parts of the social security system are not immune from the poverty premium either. And the best illustrative example of this is with the child support grant, or CSG. This is South Africa's most common grant. Every month, about 15 million grants are paid in respect of children under the age of 18 to their primary caregivers. If we can just have the next slide. This is a grant of about 530 rand a month per child. It's a means-tested grant, which means that if you earn more, it will then be reduced. Now, this 530 rand a month falls below the food poverty line. In other words, it doesn't provide enough income to provide a minimally adequate diet for an adult. Those of us with kids know that feeding a child can be a very expensive hobby indeed. So the CSG doesn't meet nutritional needs, let alone any additional needs that the child might have. Now, a number of CSG recipients are also orphans. They are cared for either by community members or by extended family members. Now, if those primary caregivers had access to information, had access to courts, had access to legal advice and had access to social workers, that primary caregiver could be appointed as a legal guardian. And when that happens, then the legal guardian can claim a foster care grant instead of the CSG. Next slide, please. And that FCG is more than double the CSG value. So not only is it above the food poverty line, it's also above the lower bound poverty line. And the difference between those orphan children receiving a CSG and the FCG, it's purely related to poverty. This is the poverty premium in action and social assistance. Now, a number of lobby groups and the Department of Social Development have been aware of this problem for many years. And as a result, recently the Department of Social Development introduced a top-up to the CSG. We can have the next slide, please. So the CSG top-up is available to any CSG recipient who is an orphan. There's no need to go through the courts. There's no need to have social workers. One just needs to prove that the child is an orphan and an additional 260 rand a month can be claimed. This does put the grant above the food poverty level, which is good in terms of what it can buy for that child, but it's still far short of the FCG. And that difference is very, very difficult to justify and really represents a poverty premium issue in the government sector.
Okay. Thanks, Megan. The role players and the stakeholders when considering poverty premium and other social issues are many. And we do touch on this in the article that's in the actuary. At this stage, the working group did not wish to propose solutions to the challenges arising from poverty premium, though we do consider some various options in the article. I think the most important question that we did have next was where to next for ASSA and poverty premium. Lusani did touch on that a bit, where he said that we're hoping that this work will lead to policy papers and briefs. But I'd like to send this question to Professor Fandiyeva to advise us as a actuarial profession where to next. And I'll also open up the floors to any questions. If there's any questions on the floor, if you could also just raise your hand to ask a question after Professor Fandiyeva has responded.
Yeah, I think there's probably two areas. I mean, the one is participation in the discussion on the wider system of social security in South Africa. It can be seen as a threatening discussion, but the an area where I've published papers as well is to recognize the distinction between private insurance and social insurance. Social insurance is really a regime that attempts to compensate for the areas that private insurance can't address. So the issue of underwriting, for instance, is an unavoidable feature of private insurance. And so the logic of underwriting can mean that if somebody is in a lower socioeconomic group, therefore their life expectancy is lower than somebody else, therefore their premiums will be higher than somebody who's higher income, for instance. So that actually creates a negative effect. It works against the kind of redistribution that you need to protect people who are more vulnerable. So the question is, how do you create a system that addresses that additional vulnerability rather than penalizes it? And it's very difficult for private insurers who are competing on their underwriting practices, because that's where the profits come in. If you can segment the group sufficiently and be underwriting more efficiently than your competitor, then you're actually going to accentuate these particular problems in vulnerabilities in the system. You're going to exacerbate them rather than compensate for them. But that's a necessity in a competing environment in order to be sustainable in a market. There's a difference between group cover and individual cover, and even people who are not poor in the individual market are also discriminated against significantly because of underwriting practices, and that's quite recognized, that these are everybody who's compelled to access insurance in an individual environment faces much higher premiums, much higher costs, lower coverage than people in group environments. The logic of the group environment is that the pooling mechanisms allow you to provide more significant cross-subsidies and to ignore these differences. Social insurance tries to do that at another level. In other words, it tries to say, well, what we're interested in is maximizing coverage based on the most vulnerable and the cross-subsidies. We recognize that a market is not going to be able able to do that efficiently. So how do you do this? So one way is you eliminate anti-selection through mandatory contributions, you ensure that benefits are uniform across the system, and this is the problem that has been recognized in health insurance, is that you have to risk equalize across a range of competing insurers, so that you can't have one insurer who ends up with an unfair distribution of bad risks. So these are problems that social insurance designs have to compensate for. They are not socialist insurance. They're social insurance. They're talking about how to broaden the pool, how to deepen the pool and eliminate the unfairness from that occurs when you have to, in a commercial market, underwrite. So so that's one issue that requires that there is a sort of an adult discussion on the design of these systems. And South Africa doesn't have them. So there's a discussion on those as to how they evolve, and then how they articulate with other forms of income protection, such as social assistance, and even contribution subsidies into a system. We don't have those. So that's a discussion that has to happen, and a large part of that framework is about what government does. Government hasn't been really coming to the party on this discussion, so to some degree it's a bit esoteric at the moment, but the issue is that it's actually essential to have these conversations with people who understand risk, transfers of risk, and that's a very valuable contribution to this kind of thinking. But on the other hand, to the extent that there is unfair discrimination in the way in which premiums are set and the way the market functions, it actually is incumbent on the system itself to eliminate practices and misconduct at that level. If there is an unfair transfer of risk to individuals and vulnerable families, that should be avoided where possible. And there are lots of instances of that. The science of underwriting is not always a science, even though it's actuarial science. I'm speaking as an economist. Mm-hmm. My dad was an actuary, so... the issue is actually looking at fairness. The only problem that exists there, if somebody can make a profit by beating somebody else, by charging a higher premium for less coverage and make a profit from it because the market's not perfect and there are asymmetries of information, how do you deal with that? That can be done collectively as an industry. If government regulators are very weak on looking at this issue, then it's incumbent on the industry to try and eliminate these problems. But I think that it's a set of issues that the industry itself will understand very profoundly, and therefore it's valuable if one actually resolves those things collectively. So I think these two areas, the problems that are inherent in the commercial market itself, practices that involve unfair transfers of risk, and there is participation in a substantive way in solving the wider distributional problems that can't be solved by the industry, but where the competence and capabilities of the industry can contribute enormously to basically upgrading our system of social transfers.
Okay, thank you. Are there any questions?
Okay. See one little bit. Okay.
Yeah.
Hi. I think most of the panel know me. I'm chair of the ASISA Social Security Committee. This is something that we're also working on. I'd like the panel's view on, Alex, you touched on it, mandation, so making this compulsory. I think that removes a lot of the anti-selection effect, and we've actually found that big enough players will have sort of reasonably stable populations that the underwriting isn't really an issue. It's more just in terms of how we deal with fraud. The other big benefit of that is cutting out distribution costs. I think we all recognize how difficult it is to acquire policies with this cohort. And then, Francois, it removes the need for the graduated premiums that you were talking about. I think from an industry perspective, we would then have to sort of compromise in some way, so there would need to be some sort of minimum product standards that would need to apply. And again, the panel's view on that, or potentially the state as a player and a referee in the space at the same time. And we know that the state doesn't play nicely when we look at education and health. And then I suppose, finally, in the current political environment, is this even a palatable discussion to have? Thanks.
Thank you.
Quite a lot of complex questions there, but I'm happy to start off with the mandation one, because we do have case study of that with regard to the Unemployment Insurance Fund and the Compensation Fund. So the Compensation Fund does actually offer a funeral benefit. It is about 18,000 rand. if you are killed on duty. And those claim rates are reasonably high and reasonably good. However, they do rate by industry. And how palatable that is will remain to be seen. The Unemployment Insurance Fund offers a death benefit, but what we can see there is one of the dangers of mandation. Because it's automatically paid for, people tend to forget that it's there. So at the time when a claim actually comes through, the family might not be aware that the benefit is actually available for them. So UIF has a contributing population of about 10 million people, and they pay 1,500 death claims a year, which is far less than what you'd expect it to be, simply because there's not that education around it. So yes, I think mandation could work, and I think we would need to leverage off some of the structures that we have now. Definitely not saying the UIF is perfect. I have attempted to get a death benefit out of the UIF once, and only once. So we need to leverage off what we've got, but we need better education. We see it with the grants. If people don't know that something is available, they won't go and get it. And that could be very dangerous, but I think mandation is almost our only option if we're going to avoid competition issues and provide coverage.
Just on the issue of political environment, I don't know what you're referring to, because I think our political environment is up in the air at the moment. We don't know where we're going yet. We'll know after the elections which way things are going. But I think what has been clear in the last couple of years is the intention to have some of these social security things in place, but hesitation as well because of lack of support and lack of common ground across the board in the country in terms of what actually needs to happen. So there has been a lot of hesitation, and therefore there hasn't been any progress. There was a paper that was released and then taken back, and we haven't seen the new one. In terms of the Actuarial Society of South Africa and the Social Reform Committee, have been involved trying to bring stakeholders together to discuss those issues, to just make sure that there is a common ground being set. That's a role that we can play. Similarly, with the NHI, which is sort of the big elephant in the room, obviously we're talking life today, so we're not talking that, but that is a form of a social security insurance. I know Alex doesn't like that one, so I'm gonna get him up the wrong way. Alex is both a fan of government and its most fervent critic, because the implementation aspect of it, it's not always the way it should be, but. We have to find a place, a role. We have to find a role for ourselves as professionals in working with the kind of political principles that are going to be given to us after the 29th, and see how best can we work with them to have a state, to have a government that can provide some kind of livelihoods for our people. So that is what informs our view. That's what informs our actions. And that's what should drive us forward. Yeah.
Okay. Sorry. In the interest of time, I think there are some questions online as well, but we did start slightly late. I would like to. There was a call that if there are any people who would like to actually join the Poverty Premium Working Group, to actually call, contact Sandy Govender, because we are hoping that we can take these conversations further, have these discussions, and have some proposals or actions at the ASSA convention. So if any people would like to join the Poverty Premium Group, to please do so. But mostly I'd like to thank our panelists for actually agreeing to participate. A special thanks to Professor Funda Yeva, who's not a member of ASSA and has another session at 10 o'clock now. So thank you so much for participating.
Thanks.
Thank you.